Hello, Capital Region. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Amy Loria. We start off today with Troy's last real journalist, Luke Stoddard-Nathan, filling us in on the local latest.
And then after that, we have a Nature Lab segment with Kathy.
Afterwards, CollarWorks radio correspondent Justin Baker continues his interview with Brian Sermo.
And later on, we'll learn about some physics with David Borton.
Lastly, we'll hear science students at the Darrow School about the Hudson River.
But first, some headlines. Troy is completing the first phase of updates to its parking system this week. Bags over parking meters in the city will be gone by Wednesday, and visitors will be able to pay up to 4 hours to park on River Street, 2nd, and 3rd at the new meters.
In other city news, Troy has hired River Street Planning to overhaul its zoning ordinance. Last updated in the 80s, the ordinance is currently written for suburban and automobile infrastructure. The new code will be geared more towards Troy's urban character and in line with the city's comprehensive plan, which emphasizes compact neighborhoods, sustainable infrastructure, and transportation options. Zoning rules will set standards for maximum and minimum building heights, orientation and parking requirements, while protecting the historic fabric of the city and encouraging new uses on former industrial waterfront land. The city has approved the contract for just under $200,000.
An exciting auditory event is taking place at MPAC on Wednesday. Okeanos takes the audience on an auditory underwater journey around the globe. Years of recordings from pole to pole will be performed with three audio systems in the concert hall, a dome of 64 loudspeakers used to project sounds around the audience in an ambisonic environment, a wave field synthesis array consisting of hundreds of small speakers placed above the audience, and a custom-built infrasound speaker used to create the lowest frequencies which can be felt more than they can be heard. The composition includes songs, signals, and vibrations from the smallest crustaceans to the loudest and largest animals ever to have existed. The event starts 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, March 20th, and tickets start at $6. Go to mpac.rpi.edu/events.
Also happening Wednesday, poetry open mic at Psychedelicatessen. Relaxed open mic in a psychedelic environment. Guests sit in the cozy chairs of the back room and share what they think is poetry, usually followed by thoughtful discussion on art, poetry, life, and what it means to create. March 20th at 6:30 p.m.
Albany Council members have hatched a new plan to allow residents to keep chickens in their backyards. About 8 years ago, the Albany Common Council narrowly approved lifting a prohibition on chickens. Specifically, hens, the female egg-laying bird, but it was vetoed by then-mayor Jerry Jennings, who argued the proposal didn't address enforcement issues or violations. But this time, the proposal sponsor, Tom Hoey, Owusu Anene, and Judy Doshete, worked with city administration and are confident that allowing residents a few hens in their backyard could be a welcomed addition to Albany.
A budget proposal from a Hudson Valley Assemblywoman could help significantly curb agriculture-related carbon dioxide emissions while also improving soil health for New York farmers. The proposal, submitted by D.D. Barrett, D. Columbia, Duchess, would create a carbon farming pilot program, which would incentivize farmers to remove excess CO2 from the atmosphere and sequester it in the soil by adopting different soil management practices. This would both improve soil health and move carbon from the atmosphere into the ground, where it's beneficial for plants and less harmful for humans. And perhaps most importantly, improved soil management could help improve farm profitability as farmers spend less on labor and fuel by reducing tillage and spend less on fertilizers or on flood management. Ultimately, the state may work out a deal with New York's farmers where they agree to implement soil management practices in order to receive tax credits.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC, WOOS's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM Troy, 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Today, as every Tuesday, the much-loved and highly regarded Luke Stoddard-Nathan fills us in on news and views about goings-on in and around the Collar City.
This week, or rather last week, I visited Edible Uprising Farm, which is a yet-to-exist but will soon exist farm that is sort of due east of the Rensselaer County Jail, sort of up Thompson Street and next to the South Troy Dodgers Field. It'll be about an acre of land. It's being started by two people with some past farming experience who originally are from Colorado. Their names are Ben Stein and Alicia Brown. And they had actually been looking to buy farmland in Vermont, but instead, kind of by happenstance and through a mutual connection with the property owner, John Johansson, settled on Troy after a visit late last year. And so they're leasing this land rather than buying it outright. And they told me that they sort of were happy, although they didn't kind of plan on this whole urban farming thing. They're sort of happy about it, because the vegetable farm scene in Vermont, and vegetable farming is sort of what they're kind of is going to be their bread and butter, at least initially. The vegetable farm scene in Vermont is sort of saturated, and they would have had to, like, you know, make syrup and other sorts of, you know, kind of specialty goods and export it rather than focus on, you know, doing a kind of more traditional sort of CSA, where they sell shares of, like, you know, to, so that people can get vegetables locally, you know, every week. They are now currently clearing brush on the property and also sort of planning its layout, which they're pretty much already certain will be about the sort of two little caterpillar tunnels or like little greenhouses surrounded by fairly densely planted beds. And they've already like tested the soil and stuff, and they think that one of them called it prime agricultural soil, apparently, which
great.
Which is surprising to me, I guess, someone not that familiar with farming. But the land they said is in pretty good condition.
I think it had previously been farmland.
Yes, eons ago, perhaps, or at least a while
a few
ago.
Decades,
not
yeah.
Eons, maybe, but yeah. You know, and one other kind of funny thing about this project that stuck out to me is that Alicia Brown said that digging a well in the city is not allowed, and which would be better probably for their project. So they'll have to use city water, which is treated with chlorine, which is not so great for the soil. So they'll have to they're going to filter it or use holding tanks to let the chlorine
dissipate
or something before they use it. So they're developing a strategy to deal with that, but that's just a sort of funny twist to it. The project is going to be reviewed by the city's zoning board of appeals on the 26th of this month. They're looking for support from the community to kind of cheer them on, although I don't anticipate them having much of a problem, but maybe I'm naive. I think they need at least one like use variance, because I don't know that farming is sort of this thing that you can just do as of right. And they may need other, they may be building some sort of small stand or structure that may also need to get the seal of approval. The plans haven't been made public at the ZBA the last time I checked, on the city website yet. They're aiming for about 30 large shares in the CSA. The pricing scheme sort of range, and also the size that you can get, I think, will range. There's several hundred dollars probably, give or take, depending on what you choose. And they told me that they've already sold about a quarter of those shares. So I don't know. Act now if this is something that's interesting to you, and that you can find out. They have a nicely designed website, and they've had some also nicely designed flyers that you might see around town. That's Edible Uprising Farm.
Where can people go to learn more?
Oh, edibleuprisingfarm.com. Also this last week, I got through a Freedom of Information Law request, a couple years old study of the Uncle Sam bikeway. The Uncle Sam bikeway, I should clarify immediately, is now sort of regarded as this like 6+ mile trail that almost goes from the northern tip of Troy all the way down to the Menands Bridge, through a southern portion of the trail that was recently extended. I say trail just for ease of terminology. It kind of goes on the street at some points and off the street. It goes in a contra flow part of during one stretch, which is like two lanes, you know, on the street but separated from the street. I'm just talking now about the portion that goes from Northern Drive, which is again is like at the northern tip of Troy, down to Middleburg Street, you know, kind of the beginnings of North Central,
right here in our neck of the woods.
Yeah, right around here. And it's on an old sort of old rail line at one point. It sort of cuts along the eastern edge of the more densely developed areas of Troy, you know, kind of dividing that portion from more sort of woodsy or parkland, you know, on the east side of that, on the east side of the trail. But it is paved. And the study looks, and the study was never, as far as I can tell, was never released to the public. I'm not sure why. I think like Capital Roots and some other organizations helped to kind of put it together. But it was never released. And other plans have come out, and it's mentioned in another study that was released last year, but this study itself was never released. In any event, it kind of looks at ways to improve this trail, and some of them, if you've ever ridden this trail on your bike or walked it, will be pretty obvious. One kind of thing that could be improved about this trail is that it doesn't really let you get on and off at very many points, despite it being so close to all these different kind of sites of interest. I mentioned in Troy Letter that it abuts at least three parks, big parks, and four different schools, the Lansingburg High School, Knickerbocker Middle School, Rensselaer Park Elementary School, and Catholic Central High School, without really formally connecting to any of them. There may be, you know, sort of informal ways that you could conceivably get on and off the trail, but it's sort of it's a missed opportunity, and it's sort of like it speaks to when this trail was created, I think in the early 80s, back at a time when, you know, maybe we thought of as this like distinct fitness or recreation activity,
right,
that
like
you get on the trail
there to go biking as opposed to integrating it into your daily life.
Exactly. So it kind of limits the bike trail as a commuting opportunity, or just as a way to get to your friend's house or something. Like, you wouldn't take it. And so that then kind of has a cycle effect on you, because it's not used as much, it feels less safe. The plan also talks about how the shrubs and the trees around the trail should be trimmed or kind of pruned back, so that there's more visibility from outside, so that it doesn't feel so scary and kind of isolated. I think people are afraid to use it, and so then it doesn't get used, and so then it actually is, you know, conceivably less safe to use. Then there's all sorts of recommendations about like, oh, there should be a safety and security plan, or like a maintenance plan, and like a trail or a code of conduct on it, sort of. And then it also points out that the city should have come up with some sort of plan to resurface it. There's some parts where, you know, on bike trails, it's common for a lot of, like, if nothing's done for a while, like roots to kind of grow underneath the pavement, and then that makes for a really rocky ride. So the plan says it should, and this was written a couple of years ago, completely resurface the trail within the next 5 to 7 years, which, I don't know, I've been at some city council meetings recently, or at least the most recent one, where there was a lot of talk about how many potholes there are in downtown Troy.
Right.
And it seems like there would be outrage, at least on Facebook, if not in real life, at one of these meetings, if the city resurfaced a bike trail before it patched every single pothole throughout the city. And, you know, so I don't know about the political viability of making that happen unless, you know, I guess there was a concerted effort on the part of, you know, groups like Transport Troy or other people who really care about this stuff to kind of champion it. Yeah. And the report also includes a cost summary of like all the different improvements that they suggest for the trail. I will say that although it seems like a lot of those potential improvements aren't really in the cards for anytime soon, one of the city planning staffers said at a recent Transport Troy meeting that the city is kind of looking at or is planning to rather install new wayfinding signage along the trail, kind of that says like, oh, if you're at this point, like it's, you know, 3 miles to Lansingburg or something like that. That's sort of consistent. It kind of gives the trail a cohesive brand or look. And then it's also going to be the city's also going to be installing different intersection treatments, you know, crosswalks or at least some kind of, because the trail crosses streets that automobiles travel on a couple different times. And right now there's little to no kind of, hey, automobiles, bikes are crossing here, which, you know, if you've ever traveled on the bike trail that goes from like Cohoes to Schenectady, that trail does, at least as I recall, a really good job of kind of marking where the bike trails cross the streets.
Yeah,
it's like there's no mistaking that this is a bike trail that's crossing and cars should slow down so that they don't T-bone anyone. And then one other story that I had last week is and this is sort of the end of an era, I think, or signals an end of an era that maybe we already knew was happening. The Capital Land taxi stand at 4th Street and Ferry at the southeast corner of 4th and Ferry has closed. This, and there was recently a Times Union story where the Times Union talked to the owner of Capital Land, Brett Peake, who I spoke to also for my story, that talked about how the impact of ride hailing in this region has been really felt, no surprise, by the taxi industry in this area. And apparently Capital Land has also closed offices in Schenectady and Saratoga Springs and is also planning to shift its Albany operations to another office that it already has, I guess, in Colony. So sort of really contracting its taxi business. And sidebar, apparently Capital Land is not going away. They're just getting more into like the medical transport industry or business that I guess is more viable. I talked to Brett Peake and he said, yeah, you know, he confirmed that office is closing. It's sort of funny because, as I noted in the story, the taxi stand is closing just as the Rosenblum Companies almost across the street is starting this big apartment construction project at the site of the former Key Bank that closed. In a way that's kind of really complicated and unwieldy to explain, and I won't go into too much detail, Capital Land basically helped facilitate that Rosenblum project, that specific property, because they sort of traded a parking lot that they controlled through Rosenblum to the city in exchange for Rosenblum buying two lots that were city owned and that had been foreclosed on. For Rosenblum acquired those properties, demolished a building on one of them, and then sort of gave Capital Land on its one where the stand is a bigger parking lot. So a lot of brain power is a fairly complicated land deal that the city set up to make this Rosenblum project happen, but that wouldn't have happened if not for Capital Land, and now it's closing. So I don't know. That's just sort of a funny happening that Capital Land was kind of involved in that. So I pointed that out in my story this week. Mm-hmm. If I have time, I also this week, and it's, you can't go anymore, but I guess I'll just make a broader comment about Troy Foundry Theater. This is a fairly new theater company in Troy that has sort of made a name for itself quite quickly at producing sort of outside the box, choose your own adventure kind of productions. The most recent one that just ended yesterday on Sunday, I was there. It was called the Prohibition Project, and it was at It was performed at Collar Works, which is in the Hudson Art House apartment building, mm-hmm. which is not far from here on River Street. And the gist of the show was just that a bunch of different actors were playing sort of people from that who we think of as like kind of classic characters of the Prohibition era, you know, like a boxer and a crooked politician and a labor organizer, sort of a Kate Mulaney-esque labor organizer, and like a socialite and all these sorts of characters who would variously come together in the performance to do sort of more interpretive, kind of abstract, kind of
improvisational,
I don't know that any of it was improvised necessarily, but it was sort of more evocative and kind of interpretive, if you will. And then the characters would separate and go into little mini scenes that the audience was able to follow, and then they would come back together and then they would separate. It was sort of impossible, although some things repeated, I guess, if you were really diligent about where you went as an audience member, you could follow all the different plot lines, but it was sort of hard, deliberately so, I think. It was sort of meant to make you feel like, oh, so much is happening. It creates a really liveliness to it. Yes. So it was really fun and sort of unconventional, and they had a bar that was serving like Prohibition era drinks and stuff. And I caught up briefly with the director, Brenna Geffers, who's I guess associated with this company called Diecast that's based in Philly, who Troy Foundry Theater basically commissioned to do this, to help them put on this show, about how do you choreograph this sort of thing. And she sort of was very sort of blasé about it and just said that it comes down to timing. All the actors have their own track and they know what to do and when they can't be late, and they're listening for cues. And so I guess what you would probably I guess the answer that maybe you would expect. And another sort of fun fact about it is that all the actors wrote their own parts. So it wasn't something that was dictated from top down, and it seemed like the actors had fun putting on the performance. The company is kind of midway through, I guess, their spring season, and they're going to put on a new dark comedy in late May. One funny thing about the Troy Foundry Theater is that they don't have like a home base besides being in Troy. So they pick different locations for each of their works. So they haven't even announced where the location is of their next performance. But tickets will go on sale next month, so I guess look out for that. they're definitely an unconventional company. Like their last performance was at the Gas Holder building. And it had all these, it was sort of a Beckett, it was a performance of a bunch of little Beckett shorts. Really cool space to see theater in. So I guess stay tuned for that.
Thanks, Luke.
Thank you.
And thank you as always for joining us, Luke. We look forward to hearing more from you next week.
Nature Labs correspondent Kathy High interviewed chemistry professor Emily Abuya from Russell Sage College about her fascinating research around water quality and environmental justice.
Hi, Emily Abuya is here with us today. Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Mm-hmm. And I know you teach at Russell Sage and you're a chemistry professor.
Yeah.
But I also know that, first of all, you've agreed to join the advisory board for Nature Lab here at the Sanctuary, which really are excited about.
I'm excited too.
And we are working on some projects coming up, one of which is around water quality and environmental justice. And I think this is a big issue historically because of things like Flint, Michigan, and what happened in Hoosick Falls around here and lots of other places. And I know you feel the same way and very passionate about this issue, but you told me you were doing some work in Kenya.
Yeah.
And that a lot of your research comes from Kenya. So
yeah.
I wondered if you could talk to us about what you were doing there and what your relationship was to that area and how you ended up sort of bringing that research here.
Okay. So first of all, when I was working at Russell Sage, I was working on a different project, because I'm a trained inorganic chemist. And so my research was mainly focusing on designing nanomaterial catalysts for environmental remediation. Mostly the catalysts, I was using them to clean up water that's contaminated with dyes, like, you know, cloth dyes once they're washed into the river. I was trying to find a mechanism of, using nanomaterial catalysts to clean up the dyes. But as I started working in SAGE, SAGE is a liberal arts college. We don't have a, you know, a large chemistry major population. We don't have as many students for that type of work. And we need advanced equipment, you know, which we don't necessarily have in our labs. So I decided to shift my research agenda to something that was more practical and something that could be done by students either in chemistry or biochemistry, students in their first year or second year, at whatever level of, you know, their college careers they would be. So I noticed that in the Capital District, there was a lot of water quality issues. And so I decided to shift my research agenda in that direction. And particularly, I was more interested in water quality because I come from Kenya. Kenya is a third world country, which means that a lot of the neighborhoods, especially in the rural areas, don't have access to clean water. There's not, you know, highly, you know, sophisticated water treatment plants or water distribution systems. So you find that residents just use the water that they have access to, which is mostly water in boreholes or water in unprotected wells or water in rivers, which usually end up being highly contaminated with microbiological contaminants. And so my research agenda, because it was around water quality, I wanted the focus to the case study to be in Kenya. And so I wrote a grant to the EPA, and I requested for some money to do a water quality testing for the water in that specific community in Kenya. And then my students and I proposed a method for cleaning, a very simple, cost-effective method for cleaning water that's contaminated in bacteria. Mm-hmm. And this method is called SODIS, solar disinfection. Mm-hmm. So pretty much just taking contaminated water, putting it in a plastic bottle, and exposing it to the sun for a couple of hours. So this grant was supposed to be a student-led project. So that's I had fantastic. The idea, but the students developed the project. Wow.
And what city was this in? And by the way, I just want to say that we're speaking with Emily Abuya, who's here from Russell Sage College, a chemistry professor, talking about her work in Kenya. And what city was it in Kenya? Or was it in various places?
In Kisumu, Kisumu, Kenya. Mm-hmm. Kisumu is one of the cities just by the Lake Victoria. It's a rural community, which, you know, is where our main case study was. Yeah.
Great, great. And you said that before I reintroduced you that you were working with, this was really a student-led project.
Yes.
So how did that work?
The EPA funds a national design competition challenge, which gives specific schools grant money to have students design a project, execute it, and be really part of the drivers in that project. So when I proposed this idea to the EPA and the project got funded, I had to work with a group of students from Russell Sage who are part of the process of coming up with a research problem, coming up with the methods of study, planning the whole process of getting the data and actually doing the research. And some of the students did travel with me to Kenya to execute the project. So after a whole year of planning, I traveled with three of the students to Kenya, and they actually executed the research work. They tested the water from 160 residents and proceeded to test the water to see whether the SODIS method that we had proposed actually works or not.
What did you find?
We found that the water is highly contaminated. The water from, we tested about five water sources that were the ones that were mostly used by the residents from that community. And all the water sources were contaminated with both coliforms and E. coli, which is a fecal indicator for microbiological contamination. We also found that the same water that we took from the sources, we tested it with the SODIS method. And SODIS was actually able to get rid of all the bacteria in all the water samples by about 5 hours of exposure time. So we found that SODIS is a method that can potentially be used as a cost-effective method for water treatment.
So 5 hours of exposure time to the sun?
To sunlight.
That's it? That's so simple. That's so amazing.
Don't need chlorine. We don't need filters. You don't need any other chemical that is put in the water. You just take the water, expose it to the sun, wait for a couple of hours, and then the UV rays or UV radiation in the sun will actually go in and get, you know, kill the bacteria in the water.
That's incredible. Yeah. Do you think that the sunlight is different in Kenya than it is here? I mean, does it have any kind of effect? Would it have the same effect here?
It would have the same effect anywhere. It's just that Kenya has, you know, lies literally along the equator. You know, the equator, you know, is right above Kenya. So we have that advantage of having the sun throughout the year. You know, so it's a resource that it's always there.
Right.
So because that resource is always there, it's the main resource that's required for the SODIS treatment. And so why not use it? That's all they need. They don't need to buy any other chlorine. They don't need to buy a filter. They don't need to buy anything. All they need is a plastic bottle, which could be a water bottle that's been used up. And then you put the water there and just leave it out in the sun. So it's really cost effective. It's very simple. And it works.
You know? Wow. Yeah. That's really incredible. It's such a brilliant way of bringing together the sort of environment that you're working in and then these very simple kind of means of treating something that's a problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, SODIS is just one of those methods that is not only limited to like a country that does not have a centralized distribution system. There are some cases where if we have flooding, let's say in the U.S., we have flooding, you know, due to a natural disaster. It means that our water distribution system will be compromised. In that specific example, it means that we will not be able to use water from our tap because it's most likely going to be contaminated. So then SODIS would be like an emergency procedure that people could use in case, you know, your water is contaminated or it's been mixed up with the sewer. And so you would be able to take that SODIS and apply it to that system in case of a natural disaster.
This has been an amazingly fascinating conversation, and I hope that you will consider coming back and continuing this talk with us again soon.
Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Emily Abuya talking about her research addressing water quality issues in Kenya.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Amy Loria. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, 105.3 FM Troy, 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
ColorWorks radio host Justin Baker interviews guest Susan Meyer about her artistic practice. Sculptures that draw inspiration from Buckminster Fuller's geodesic domes to Borscht Belt comics.
Hey, this is ColorWorks Radio. This is Justin Baker, and this week I'm here with Susan Myers. Hey, Susan, how are you doing?
Hi, good. How are you?
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Great. I want to say this week I went and saw, early in the week, I went and saw the work that was at the Albany Center Gallery, and it was beautiful. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about it, and we've shown together in the past at the Mohawk Hudson Regional, was it? It was that,
yes.
Yeah, Albany Center Gallery, and we were kind of in the same section, and I thought the... our work had some similarities, or like my newer work, and with yours, and I'm a photographer and you're a sculptor, and I thought it was interesting. I got really interested in what you were doing. Previous to that, though, I had seen your work at, where was it? At ColorWorks at a show, and it was a little different, and that really struck me, too. I thought, well, that's really interesting what you're doing. So for the people listening... your work is sculpture.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of color. I think, right? Fair to say?
Yeah.
And it's all these interesting shapes based. Well, some of the stuff I saw recently, like at Albany Center Gallery, is like a geometric dome shape, right?
Right.
Or geodesic dome?
Yeah, a lot of angular geometric shapes, maybe loosely based on geodesic spheres and structures that are from a utopian kind of outlook.
Right. Yeah, so even like that part really interests me. So I don't, if you'd want to, you know, it's funny in thinking about like a sculptor, the first thing that usually comes to my mind is form. But when I think of your work, there's also this color thing, which I find super interesting. I don't know. Do you want to talk a little bit about maybe like how you use color or even where some of these ideas of the geodesic dome come from?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I loved being in that show across from you. I thought that was a really neat dialogue between those pieces. But the colors. So a lot of my work originates from this idea of utopian structures and the idea of utopian structures in the United States, both in the 1800s, when there was a lot of revival going on and things like the Oneida community or Brooks Farm and Fruitlands. But then also, I moved here from Colorado about 6 years ago, and there was a lot of activity in the 60s and 70s revolving around kind of communes and experimental communities. And one in particular, Drop City, my husband and I had a friend, kind of a well-known artist back in Denver, who was one of the founders of Drop City. And they started, like many utopian experiments did, with high hopes of kind of living on the land and living a life of the mind in combination with that. They were artists, and then eventually things get out of control for a variety of reasons, and
things go
and the
bad.
Whole thing yeah. dissolves. But
I read a little bit about
yeah.
that. It seemed to almost hinge on this one long festival they had, it seemed like some of the members got really disenchanted with it after that, when a lot of other people started showing up.
Right.
Which was kind of interesting.
Yes, because the premise is always that it will be open to everyone. And then it is, and everyone comes, and things get funky.
Things get ruined.
Yeah. And that's true, like in the mid-1800s, a lot of the utopian communities suffered the same kind of ends. Or, you know, the women would often be doing all the work in the farmhouse, and they'd get fed up and leave,
so then
it crumbled.
Like, who does the labor becomes an issue.
Right.
Because in utopia, no one does anything.
But you talked about the colors.
The color,
the
too, yeah.
So the Drop City doesn't exist anymore, but there are some really wonderful pictures of it. And it was, the droppers would go to the car, like the dump yard where they put old cars, and they would use axes to take out the hoods of the cars.
And
they
read
would
that.
Use
yeah.
those to create these really interesting geodesic spheric or dome-like houses.
Uh-huh.
And they were all a little bit different in shape, and they had kind of a nice, both beautiful but kind of rough quality, and the color was really interesting. And that's been an influence. And then my palette.
The imagery of that is...
Yeah.
Okay.
The imagery, the colors, just the kind of shapes that kind of beautiful but bereft. I'm not sure if, you know, some of my work does have a bereft quality. Some of it certainly doesn't, I suppose. But yeah, that's been an influence.
We were just talking before, and you were saying how you had studied as a painter.
Right.
You've been making your work for, in this sculptural way, for like 30 years, roughly. And as a painter, was there an attention to form, or were they more abstract, or?
They were more abstract, but it was really that kind of window of time of college and grad school, you know? So That was a long time ago. So, and in fact, the utopian stuff didn't come in until maybe about, oh, the 2000s in that, that realm.
Being so, in Colorado, maybe, was that part of it? Like, you said your husband knew someone who was from the drop. Did you say that?
Yeah, both of us did. Yeah.
Oh, you both did? Oh, that's super interesting.
Yeah, still do, I guess.
Yeah. One thing I found interesting in looking at your work, not only the color, but some of the imagery or even like some of the objects that make their way into like the rocks and some of the, well, yeah, I guess some of the imagery. But I found it really interesting with the rocks in the way that they're kind of like inside the dome. I was like looking at Albany Center Gallery. Wasn't there one where there was like a rock suspended, or was that a form that you made?
Yeah, there is a rock suspended inside of Transformer, a piece that looks a little figurative in a way. Yeah, I'm also interested in scholars' rocks. So these little objects of contemplation that particularly Asian scholars and poets would use. Small kind of intricate rocks that were either landscape-like or sometimes figurative in form, somewhat, you know, loosely. And they would be kind of objects of contemplation to from which to get inspiration. So that piece has a little bit, that piece always felt like there's this chamber that that something
really,
might happen in.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, with those pieces that were there and the dome pieces I've seen of yours in the past couple years, I mean, there's a real, like, you, I find myself kind of like looking into them, like trying to see and just kind of getting like lost. And then you stepping back and looking at the form again, and they have a kind of a presence to them that's kind of interesting.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you for being here. I think we're going to do one. You want to do one more? And we'll talk some more?
Sure.
Okay. So again, this is Colorworks Radio. I'm here with Susan Myers. My name is Justin Baker. And as always, please visit Colorworks at 621 River Street. We have the 41st Photo Regional coming up. That opens in March, the end of March, March 29th. Open right now is the Alpaca Gallery, the Sage College, 140 New Scotland Avenue, Place of Now. That's open till April 14th. Go check that out. Great looking show. And also the University Art Museum at University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue. Two great shows, or actually three shows to check out. We Are Here and Wrapped is the other show. And then there's Luis Lawler Bird Calls, which is a sound piece that's going to be in the lobby. Or it is in the lobby. Very cool. Again, thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And that was Colorworks radio host Justin Baker speaking with artist Susan Meyer.
We are back with physicist and solar boat builder Dr. David Borton. On this episode of his segment, Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics, he and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone discuss music, sound, and the time before complexity when we all just sat on the cosmic shores.
We are back with physicist and solar boat builder David Borton. Nice to see you, David.
Always good to see you, Megan. How are you?
I'm doing well. I was just listening to a podcast called Weird Studies, and the man, J.F. Martel, who does the podcast, talked about his deep love of music, and that music actually is one of the reasons why he's happy to be alive on planet Earth. Are you a huge music lover?
Well, huge is too strong a word, but I definitely like some kinds of music, yes.
So what are your musical tastes?
My musical tastes are from the 50s and 60s, and they're country, guitar-type things, and I like the harp.
So the harp is an interesting instrument to record because it has all of these overtones and reverberations to it. It's actually difficult to record harp music.
I suspect that's because the overtones come from the strings. And you know how a string makes music? Okay, you pluck it.
You pluck it.
And what happens if you pluck it in the middle compared to if you pluck it at a quarter of the way?
You have a more deep, rich sound if you pluck the string in the middle. If there's more tension on that string towards the top and the bottom.
Okay, so I'm going to say that slightly differently. If you pluck it in the middle, you generate the first harmonic, not the first harmonic, the bass note. What's the bass note called if it's not a harmonic?
Oh, geez.
Well, it's the lowest frequency that you can generate from the string if you pluck it in the middle, where if you pluck it closer to the end, you can generate more than just the basic frequency. You can generate harmonics, and those harmonics are probably what makes it so that it's hard to record.
Oh, okay. Does it interest your mind to think about the translation over time of how human beings have enjoyed and engaged with music?
Oh, sure. I don't know very much about it, but what was the first music? What would you say the first music was?
Singing.
Singing. Okay, so people recognized that their voice could be used to make different sounds. And do you think they liked that and wanted to make different sounds other ways?
Or, I mean, it's interesting. I'm not sure whether it was just engagement with the realm of sound or singing. Who knows what humans first really engaged with in terms of one sound after another, using their voice, taking a stick and doing percussion, you know?
Yeah, okay. But there's also, I like to eat. And one of the things you might like to eat is a bird. And how can you tell whether the bird would be something you might like to eat, like, I don't know, a chicken versus what you might not like to eat, like maybe a vulture? How would you tell the difference between a chicken and a vulture?
Through the sound.
Through the sound. Okay. So sound is important because eating is important. Okay. And have you ever heard a ruffed grouse?
No.
Okay. Well, they beat on their chest and it makes a very nice hollow sound from the ruffed grouse. And do you think they're good to eat?
Yes.
Yes. And so if you heard that sound and you were hungry, you might say, well, let's go get a ruffed grouse because that would be good to eat. If you heard a zebra or an elephant, which one do you think you might have a better chance of getting for dinner?
The zebra.
Right. So you might want to hear the difference between the noise of a zebra and an elephant. And then suppose you heard a zebra or a gazelle. Which one do you think you'd go after?
Gazelle.
Gazelles are really fast.
Oh, zebra.
So it's harder to catch a gazelle than it is to catch a zebra.
Yeah.
So, again, if you're hungry and you hear two different animals, one in one direction and the other in the other, you're going to live better if you know which is which and follow the sound of the one that you're more likely to be able to catch.
Huh. This is going in a territory that I didn't really expect it to go into, which is all of the different mechanisms of sound. And is there a physics to sound waves?
Yeah, sound, I like to talk about energy, especially solar energy. Sound is a form of energy because you've got this string that you pull back, and when you let go of that string, you've taken the potential energy of pulling it, and you've put it into the kinetic energy of the string's motion. And it's that motion that generates the sound that you hear. Your ear is really quite good at picking up small amounts of power density. You can hear a harp from far away, even though there's very little energy in plucking that string.
Yes. So different instruments also have different power, it seems, in terms of the reach of those individual sounds.
Right. And you've heard bass drums, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do bass drums do?
Reverberate.
Yeah,
deeply.
They can make the floor shake, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because you put a lot of energy into banging on that drum, and that energy is vibrational energy, and that vibrational energy can affect not just your eardrum, but the floor, other things.
So we're looking at a lit candle right now, and in terms of sound waves, is there a relationship between light and the emitting of light and sound waves as they travel through us and around us when an instrument makes music or another human being sings?
Certainly there is, but it's a little bit of a stretch to go from light and heat from a candle to the energy in a sound wave. But that's all energy. And if you think about it, three lifetimes ago, how would people understand the relationship of the energy between light and heat and sound? That's pretty subtle stuff. Mm-hmm. And physics has figured out those things. We started talking about gravity. Gravity's not so subtle. Mm-hmm. Okay, but it still took Isaac Newton to figure out quantitatively the physics of gravity. It took a lot more to figure out the fact that heat and light were energy, that sound was energy, that heat and light are related to electricity. Electricity, wow, what's that? It's energy, comes in lightning, it makes sound. So all these things are definitely related, but the physics is easier to talk about separately.
So when you were a kid, just to briefly go into the biographical realm, you've often talked about how your vision of the ideal human life is really just, I think how you said it was, how we're supposed to live is really surrounded by trees, water. We are supposed to be deeply connected with nature. So did you have moments when you were growing up where people were around a fire and you could bounce these ideas off of people, where you were thinking about light and heat and even sounds, whether it was actual music that you and your friends were making or the sound of the crackling of the fire that you were sitting around? Did you just have moments of togetherness and community with people talking and thinking about these things?
Absolutely. You asked a lot of questions all in one there.
I have a terrible habit of doing that.
The thing is that this is basically in our
just
genetic,
answer one.
genetic makeup, because we evolved sitting around a fire. Why did we sit around a fire?
Heat and light.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we sat around the fire for heat and light and for cooking food. Why do we cook food?
Nutrition.
Well, it makes more foods available to us, so we actually get more energy out of what's around if we cook the food. Mm-hmm. So that was a great thing to learn. So when you're sitting around a fire and you want to be someplace where you can survive, besides food, you need
water.
Water. So sitting around water is a very good thing. And so people would, you know, light a fire and sit around water and eat and drink, be merry. And it's a wonderful way to exist still. I mean, we've got cars and electricity and all that stuff. But if you go someplace where there aren't those things, you can still sit around a fire and eat and drink and have a good time. And it's really from our genetic background.
My brother often cites some statistic that if you go back into hunter-gatherer times, people only worked, if you averaged it out, something like 20 hours a week to hunt their food and gather their resources, as opposed to modern humans living these really oddly complex lives where we're going from cars to jobs to make money. There's degrees to the resource.
We could talk about that for quite a while.
That was our weekly Physics Bucket with correspondent Megan Marone interviewing physicist Dr. David Borden.
Leah Penniman's students at Darrow School, K.D. DeKayet and Haley Burt, report on invasive species and their latest findings on the Hudson River.
This is Leah Penniman, science teacher at the Darrow School in New Lebanon, New York, here with my students K.D. and Haley, who are about to share their findings on the Hudson River.
Hello, good afternoon. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie. We are from Darrow School.
And today we'll be talking about invasive species in the Hudson River.
But what even are invasive species?
Invasive species are what they sound like. They are species that belong to another part of the world and travel to other places. Now, what impacts do invasive species have? They almost always have negative impacts on the environment. Now, one invasive species is the
zebra mussel, a small freshwater mussel. The species was originally native to the lakes of southern Russia and Ukraine. However, the zebra mussel has been accidentally introduced to numerous other areas, including the Hudson, over 27 years ago, and has become an invasive species in many countries worldwide.
Hasn't the zebra mussel caused billions of dollars in damage by blocking intake pipes and water flow?
Yes, they do this by forming colonies along and inside the pipes. They also throw off the ecosystem, causing food web changes. Enough change to compare to the disturbance of acid rain, toxins, and nutrient pollution.
Oh, and did you know another species that comes from the same area as the zebra mussel is the bloody red shrimp?
Oh, tell us more.
The bloody red shrimp is native to the Pontonio-Caspian region of Eastern Europe. The impact of this species on the Great Lakes is yet unknown, but based on its history of invasion across Europe, significant impacts are possible. The bloody red shrimp is an omnivore. Its diet includes water fleas and algae. They may compete with young fish while providing food for larger fish.
The zebra mussel is still cooler.
The zebra mussel has literally cost people billions of dollars.
Well, whatever. Getting back on topic, there are also plant invasive species. One of them is the Brazilian Alodia.
Brazilian Alodia is a bright green, robust water plant originally sold in Washington pet stores for aquariums. It roots at the bottom of freshwater bodies with highly branched stems that grow up to 18 feet to the water surface. As its name suggests, it's a South American species. Brazilian Alodia forms dense mats that choke out native aquatic plants. These mats hinder recreational activities such as swimming, fishing, and water skiing.
Ooh, water skiing sounds fun. I heard this story about
Katie!
Okay, sorry. But the Brazilian Alodia kind of reminds me of the Eurasian water milfoil. The Eurasian water milfoil is a perennial plant that flowers twice a year, usually in mid-June and late July. It is native to Europe and Asia. It was discovered in the eastern United States in the early 1900s. It also makes dense mats under the water and makes it hard to do fun activities.
It also overtakes habitat and outcompetes native aquatic plants, potentially lowering diversity. There are also many other examples we could have said, like
European frogbit. Mats of frogbit can become so thick that boat traffic can be affected by the frogbit. It can also spread from lake to lake through fragments that have broken off or stuck to a boat.
Hydrilla. Because it's rapid and dense growth, it shades out other plant species, including natives, reducing diversity to a single species. Dense hydrilla infestations increase daily swings in dissolved oxygen and pH, which influence habitat quality.
Also the water chestnut.
And the fishhook water flea.
Don't forget about the starry stonewort.
And the round goby, which one of our classmates found for the first time.
Brittle naiad.
Curly leaf pondweed.
Quagga mussel.
White perch.
Okay, I think they get the point.
Yeah, probably.
Now, since fish don't fly and plants don't teleport, how do they end up in our land?
Well, humans can be lazy, that's why.
Some people just throw goldfish in the water because they don't care to take care of their pet anymore.
So, before we were born in Australia, someone dumped a bag of unwanted goldfish into a river. They adapted to the habitat.
And grew a lot. The size of a football, in fact.
They took over the entire river.
This happens because female goldfish produce 40,000 eggs each year.
Why would people throw goldfish out?
Because society kept giving out goldfish. People probably thought they were dispensable and they started going in waterways.
This is dangerous because goldfish are every waterway's biggest nightmare. They uproot vegetation, cause excess algae growth, which in turn depletes oxygen amounts and disturbs the sediment, which releases nutrients.
Don't forget that invasive species also travel with ships sticking along the bottom.
Good point.
So basically, all in all, invasive species affect life in many ways, like costing humans money, competing with other species, or ruining the ecosystem.
We hope you enjoyed and learned about some animals and plants in the Hudson River. Goodbye. Goodbye.
This is Leah Penniman from the Darrow School. We just heard from KD and Haley, students at Darrow, sharing their research on invasive species in the Hudson River.
Thank you, KD and Haley, for sharing your findings with us.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Amy Loria.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Our engineer tonight is Felix. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. And you can also get that on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. And if you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And don't forget to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary. It's dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.